Good day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by Diadora, the brand made legendary by Bjorn Borg. Currently worn by world number 28, Jan-Lennard Struff, and world number 61, Martina Trevisan. See them at Diadora.com. Use my code, APPROVED, in all caps at HollibertSports.com for 15% off of all Diadora performance tennis shoes. ScopeSports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. With Scope Fan Clubs, you can access premium behind-the-scenes content and chat with their players that include world number 62, Flavio Cavoli, who just played Rafa yesterday, and world number 25, Talon Greeksport. See them at ScopeSports.io to see what they are all about. We have a very special show for you today. She grew up in San Francisco, the daughter of El Salvadoran immigrants, and learned tennis famously in Golden Gate Park. In 1970, she got to three in the world, and right alongside Billie Jean King as her friend and doubles partner, she is one of the original nine players to create the WTA. Known for her fiery personality and flashy attire, she was inducted into the Tennis Hall of Fame in 1996. Rosie Casals is today's guest. Now, hang on a second. Where are you? Are you in Northern California?
No, I'm in Palm Desert.
Oh, you are?
So, yeah, I moved here about 24 years ago now.
You're in the desert where I introduced myself to you. You're right where we, right at the BNP. You're right there.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
That's a tennis hotbed. That remains it. That's a perfect spot for you, right?
Well, it's a perfect spot for a lot of people. I mean, coming from the Bay Area, I lived in Sausalito for at least 35 years. I'm born and raised in San Francisco. And so it was cold. I played at Golden Gate Park where sometimes you couldn't see the ball because the ball used to be white then. So that fog would just roll in. And I think I always enjoyed the warmer weather. So that's exactly where I'm at.
That's where it's at. Woman, you hear former world number three, original player. The most original. She and Billie Jean King created women's pro tennis along with a whole bunch of others. She is one of the great personalities in the history of our sport. She is a Hall of Famer. This is Rosie Casals. Rosie, did I get all that right?
Well, I think you did. Yes, it sounded pretty accurate. So, yes.
Listen, what an honor. I'm always so excited to have the Hall of Famers on the show. As you know, we do a five-set format. The first set's the off-the-court report. Now, I know that it's heated up in the Coachella Valley since we last said hi. It was cool when we first saw each other during the tournament.
Yes. Well, I'm happy that you ran into me and I ran into you at the BNP. So it's always kind of fun to have such a incredible tournament just around the corner. So, you know, we're constantly busy.
Now, when you're there during the tournament, do you have things you do?
I generally do some things for WTA through my charity, the Love and Love Tennis Foundation. Plus, I do a fundraiser dinner on that first Saturday. So we got a lot of people to come on over, and we've been around for 15, 16, 17 years now doing it, and raise good funds for my Love and Love Tennis Foundation through, you know, a lot of the legends that we honor, a lot of the women that have been very instrumental in changing women's tennis and women's sports. So we've honored Billie Jean, and we've honored Chris and Martina. And just this March, we honored Pam Shriver. So we have some great auction items from the players. And
where do you do that dinner?
We do it at Palm Valley Country Club, which is virtually less than 10 minutes from the gardens.
And what's the point of the foundation? What is the money that you raise?
The money goes to kids. We give free clinics throughout the Coachella Valley because the desert is spread out quite a bit to the north, to the east, to the south, and to the west. And in between is all the rich gated communities. On the outskirts are the poor folks. And we try and get them started with tennis and, you know, provide them with a totally different environment.
And that's a big theme of your life, was that you came up in a hard scrabble way. You weren't a silver spoon getting chaperoned to the country clubs.
Well, yeah, I came out probably on the wrong side of the tracks, very poor, from a Latin American family. My parents were from San Salvador. So, you know, we didn't really know what tennis was. My dad was really a soccer player, but he had a broken ankle. And actually, I was brought up by my great aunt and uncle. So he started playing tennis and with his buddies and stuff. And I started bugging him every time I saw him pull that racket out of that, wooden frame. I knew he was going to Golden Gate Park. So he finally decided that he should take me. And he told me, here's a ball, here's a racket, go hit against the wooden, wall. And so that's how I got started. I must have been about 8 and a half, almost 9 years old. And I kind of never looked back. I mean, I don't remember when I couldn't hit a tennis ball. It was so natural.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court Report. Rosie, I know that you keep your eye on pro tennis. I know that you, I've seen you at the majors. I've seen you at Wimbledon. I've seen you at Tennis Hall of Fame. I've seen you throughout the years from a distance. But how are you feeling about sort of the health of the WTA at the moment?
Well, I wish I knew a little bit more about the inner workings. I mean, I know as much as probably most people that are told what they want to tell you. I know they're in a transition period of changing tournaments and status and, working with ATP and combining some of their tournaments, which I think has been a very positive thing for both. I think the relationship with WTA and ATP is extremely important for the growth of tennis. It's good to have a voice in how things are governed, how our game is governed, and that's why the associations and the players are extremely important, because they have to have a part in all of this.
How do you feel about the Saudi Arabia involvement now that we all know has happened, right? The WTA finals will be in Riyadh over the next 3 years. That just sounds like the beginning of it.
Well, I think what's important is that we don't lose sight of the reason. And I think that you can look at it in two different ways. What are we doing there? They don't respect women. It's not an encouraging thing for us to be seen there. Are we going there for money? Are we going? Yeah, of course we're going there for money. Let's be honest. Okay, money talks. I don't care who you are, whether it was China going to China or going to Saudi. Is it going to be a good tournament? Yes, it's going to be. Is it going to be plenty of money? Yeah. But I feel that if we don't go into countries like that and women don't see us, okay, be strong, play a role, participate in sports, which has always been for men and not for women. How is any of this ever going to change? It's got to be gradual changes. There have been changes, okay? And we need to understand the culture. We need to understand a lot more as they need to understand us. But I feel that if we go in with a sense, hey, you guys have got to do these things for us, okay? We got to see women there. We got to see young kids there. They got to be able to dress accordingly to the sport. They got to be able to move freely and continue these programs when we leave. And we're going to be here to check it. We're going to be here to make sure things are moving in the direction that we want them to move. Not just that we're going there, taking the money and getting out. We need to do something more.
You mentioned that you thought that the LIV golf was lousy.
No, I didn't say it was lousy. You said that.
I'll say I think it's lousy. They had events in Saudi Arabia a month and a half, 2 months ago there's no one there. It's odd. And the promotion is odd, right? It's odd.
You can see it from the Masters, okay? Who ended up winning?
A PGA guy. Scheffler.
Many of them, like Ram, and they went by the wayside because they've taken the money, but they're not playing within that quality and caliber of the PGA, where they were sharp as anything, and they were playing their best golf. So you got to make up your mind. Is it about money for some? Yeah, okay, go for money, because you've won your titles, you're tired, you're not making any progress on the regular tour. But all I'm saying is there has to be a collaboration. If you want to have the best for golf, then you have to communicate, you have to have the relationship, and it's got to be a balance. And until the PGA starts reaching out and creating a better scenario so that golf becomes popular again, because nobody knows what the hell's going on there. So that's why women's golf is starting to take off. So thank you, men.
Yeah, they've messed it up. There's no doubt. They messed it up.
Yeah.
Rosie, just a couple weeks ago, Jose Higueras penned a letter, an open letter, expressing his extreme disappointment with the USTA's cutting budget for their player development program. He was extremely adamant that this was a mistake, that it was going to affect American tennis. Are you familiar with the letter?
I am not. But just quickly comment, I know that he's been around for a very long time, involved with the USTA and the junior development programs that they had. I was part of it to some extent because I was coaching a gal, Taylor Johnson. And so I know how important it is to support some of these youngsters. And unless you have that support and you start cutting programs, look at Italy. Look at what they're doing with all the players that are coming up, both men and women. They're doing something right. Look at Barcelona. Granted, they're smaller countries, so it's a lot easier to do. But hey, you know, we need to wisen up. Let's utilize the money correctly.
Let's move into the third set. This is the portion of our show where we talk about your career. You know, I have this very strong memory. I'm certain that, you know, you may get a kick out of this. Maybe it was 1977, 1978. I think I was 7 or 8 years old. My father took me to a Boston Lobsters match in Boston Garden, and you were playing team tennis. And I just remember seeing you had like a gold tennis. You were dressed in gold.
Yeah.
And you were the flashiest player I'd ever seen. I never forgot it because I always remember you were always, you know, you were always dressed impeccably, but very flashy.
Well, thanks to Ted Tingling, who dressed a lot of the players on the Virginia Slims and gave them their look and special tennis wear that was customized to your personality. So, you know, he gave me a lot of sequins, a lot of rhinestones,
sequins.
A lot of flash.
That's what I wanted to say. Yeah.
And it was kind of fun to be able to come out. You know, we played mostly in the evening, so it was like a spectacular entrance of rhinestones and a lot of flash.
A lot of flash and dash. Let's just back up for a second. Earlier you explained how you started playing, but how'd you get good, Rosie? Where does your tennis really begin, where you started to get very good?
Well, I mean, when I started, I was a national athlete and talented, and I, you know, entered all the junior tournaments, and I started winning them. And so it kind of confirmed that I was good at it because I was beating other kids that had been playing. Fortunately, I was very lucky that A, my dad gave me fairly good technique, and B, we had really good competition at Golden Gate Park, not just in the juniors, but we had a lot of good men, Tom Brown, Tom Edelson, just some really good players that would hit with you that you could look up to. And I think it really kind of put me on the right track of being good because I had good competition.
Did you start playing Orange Bowl and Easter Bowl?
No. Not in the beginning, because Orange Bowl was in Florida, and being California, I didn't have the money to go anywhere. But, you know, as I started to win and I got a little bit older, 13s and 14s, and I was very fortunate to have a lot of help, financial help from Golden Gate and friends. They put funds together for me so I could travel to Los Angeles, Southern Cal, and go up to the Pacific Coast, Northwest, and eventually back east to play some of the national tournaments. So things were a lot cheaper then. Now, oh my gosh, you do need a lot of help. But nonetheless, to travel to tournaments and pay entry fees, yes, it costs money. And, you know, that was money that we did not have.
Was there ever like a specific win or a tournament or a week that you were like, oh, you know what? I'm one of the best in the world.
I mean, as a junior, you knew that you were damn good because you were playing and beating the juniors. I was also beating some of the seniors. I would play in some of the open women, and I was beating them. So I knew that I was a little bit special, that I had something extra because I was doing a lot better than the people that I played with, my friends and stuff that I started with. I knew right off the bat, you know, this was it for me, that this is what I wanted to do. And mind you, this was all amateur. You know, there was no such ideas of, you know, today's generation looking at, you know, I want to be like Swiatek. I want to be like Sabalenka. I want to be like hopefully Pegula or some American player. So you were playing because you love the game, and that hasn't changed.
And when did you meet Billie Jean King?
I think it was 1963. I was about 15 years old. My partner and I were playing at the Pacific Coast, which was at that time one of the highest level tournaments. And it was the last tournament on the summer tour that all the players from all over the world played. And then they would go home after this. And I was invited by Barry McKay to play in the doubles. And we played Billie Jean and Carole Hodwell. And when we looked at them, I've got the iconic picture. I mean, I saw Billie Jean with her 5-6 rackets and her Fred Perry skirt, the green one with the reefs around it and a monogram, you know, Fred Perry with her. At that time, she was Billie Jean Moffitt. So no K on that one. So I thought, God, this is what real tennis players look like. They're real good players. We ended up losing to them, you know, something like 6-4, 7-5, and it was a very close match. And I remember her saying, looking at me and saying, you know, you're really good. You keep it up. She said, I'll catch up with you.
Just like that. I'll catch up with you.
Yeah. Berkeley Tennis Club. 1963, I believe. And so maybe a year later, I played her again and got to the finals. And in 1965, I think she told me, well, look, I have my regular partner, which is Karen Sussman, who had gotten married, wanted to start a family, was going to quit. So, you know, she said, I'm looking for a partner for Wimbledon. And at that point, I had played her in the finals. Was a close match, but she beat me. And she said, would you like to play? You know, would you like to play Wimbledon? And of course, you know, wow, of course I would. There's no question. There's no other answer but yes, yes, yes. So that was the exciting part, and the fact that in 1966, I was going to graduate out of high school, which really made me happy that I could finally devote my time to playing tennis.
You were happy to finish school.
I was happy to get out. I hated school. It was the worst thing that happened in my life. One of the worst things. So I was not very disciplined. I was not very good. If I was interested in the subject, of course I would be interested. And I was always interested in reading. I was, you know, an avid reader. But as far as, you know, sitting there from 9 to 5, whatever it was, 8 to 3 o'clock, it was painful.
You had a hard time in school.
I didn't have, the hard time was from me more than anything, wanting to play tennis. I didn't want to be in school. Once I discovered tennis, it was like, as soon as that bell rung, I was going to Golden Gate Park. That was it.
That was it. So you and Billie Jean, I can't even know, how many matches do you think you even lost with her? You won everything with her.
Well, we won a lot. We won a lot. She was very special. She was very good. And we made a very good team. I think we understood one another very well. And, you know, she taught me a lot in those first couple of years of what it took to have some discipline, to work hard, to have goals, you know, because she was very goal-oriented. I mean, she was very disciplined. She came from Middle America. I came from a family that didn't necessarily say you got to be home by 8 or you got to be home by 5 and you got to do this and that. And if they did say that, I would disregard them till I understood as I got better and my competition got better and we were playing in a different arena that I had to have some discipline.
You sound like you were a little bit wild, Rosie.
Well, yeah, I mean, I like to have fun, and we always had fun in the juniors and went to parties and enjoyed one another's company and did all the bad things that you smoked and had a bit of vodka, had a bit of beer, had a bit of everything. So of course, yeah, I mean, all of a sudden I'm out of school. I'm just going to turn 18. I get a chance to finally go abroad to the place that I've been dreaming about, Wimbledon, and to have that opportunity and to go with Billie Jean, who's already been there. And I'll never forget, just before Wimbledon, she took me to Wimbledon 2 days before it. And she was given access to the center court, obviously. And she sat there and she said, "I come here to reflect and look." And it was like a cathedral. I mean, it was the greatest moment to be able to look around and say, "God, in 24 hours, this place is going to be filled with people. And I do hope I get to center court," because a lot of players don't like center court, but I loved it. I loved it. I loved Wimbledon. Still do.
You just gave me the chills, Rosie. Now, what was it like to create the WTA?
Well, let me tell you, what it was not easy when you're going to get a group of 67 women in the Gloucester Hotel on June 21st, 1973. We'd been talking to them all along about, we got to get organized, we got to establish an association or a federation or a union.
The women were getting screwed, like Jack Kramer and the guys that owned the tournaments weren't including you.
Yeah. Well, what happened was when open tennis came into the picture in 1968, and Wimbledon was the first one to open it up to pros, we had signed a contract with George McCollum and the National Tennis League, which was a professional tour that we played for almost 2 years, and we were given guarantees. So we had been on the outskirts of playing any of the sanctioned tournaments by the LTA or the ITF or whatever. So when open tennis finally came into the picture, of course the men were getting most of the prize money and the women were not, because at that time we were playing together on the circuit, especially in the US. So it was probably worse in the US that the women were really getting the raw end of the deal. And so, being very unhappy for about a year and a half, we had started to talk to the women and tell them that we needed to do something to have a voice in this game. So Larry King, Billie Jean's former husband, was very instrumental in helping us organize and getting the bylaws and coordinating the legalities of what was better for us to do, seeing that we were bringing in players from all over the world. So it was not an easy task to convince them, because they were afraid. They were threatened all the time by their respective LTAs and told that if you join any group, especially with the women, you're going to be suspended. You can't play this. And for them, it wasn't like a livelihood, but it was a living in the sense of the word that, yeah, they probably got some little money, to play this and that. But, they needed to understand what was at stake, that that little money was not enough to give them a sense of worth and to give them the opportunity to make a living. And I think that's what's in the back of Billie Jean's head all the time, is that we need to be able to make a living. We are professionals. We work just as hard as the guys do. We travel. We sacrifice all of the things that they do. So it was a long, involved thing that, those that had turned pro, it was Ann Jones, myself, Billie Jean, and Frankie Durr. And they were really the ambassadors trying to get out there and convince the women that they needed to come to the table. They needed to sign on the dotted line and get organized and start their own, association, because ATP at that point had already gotten their act together. And so they were, where we needed to be.
And what about the Virginia Slims? I mean, that's a wild, I mean, that's just a wild story. This whole thing is wild.
It is a wild story, because if it wasn't for them, women's tennis wouldn't be where it is. They knew how to promote. And yes, they were a surrogate company, Philip Morris. And at the point that we ended up, that's 1970, right after Forest Hills, Jack Kramer was really kind of probably instrumental in getting us going to understand that we were not going to get equal prize money, that we weren't not even going to get a third of the prize money. I mean, the ratio was something like 10 to 1. Consequently, we asked Gladys Helvin, who was the editor and publisher of World Tennis, the largest magazine around, tennis magazine around, whether she would help us and, you know, have some conversations with Jack Kramer to see whether he would agree to give us more money. And, you know, he just wouldn't hear of it. So we started talking about, what can we do? Can we have an alternate tournament? And so that became the Houston, the first Virginia Slims of Houston in 1970. Mind you, we ran into a lot of problems with the USTA telling us that they were suspending us if we played and the club would lose its sanction. But nonetheless, Virginia Slims stepped in, gave us the prize money in addition to the women of the Houston, Dolores Hornbecker. She was the one that had the volunteers and they raised about $5,000. For the tournament, got it out of their husbands or businesses, whatever, and became the first tournament of the Virginia Slims circuit. So happy to say I was the winner of the first. So that I'll take.
That's right. You won the first one, huh? That's pretty cool.
I won the first one, so no one can take that glory away. And that's always important to me because that was the beginning of everything that we know today. And fortunately, Gladys' relationship with Joseph Cullman III, who was the CEO and executive director of Philip Morris USA, said, I love women's tennis, and we got the perfect brand, Virginia Slims. We're trying to promote, you know, smoking with the women. And boy, did they do a fabulous campaign. And granted, yes, nowadays everybody looks at them, oh, you were with a, but, you know, they never gave us cigarettes and told us to smoke. And I mean, they were great, great sponsors who taught us how to sell women's tennis. I mean, they put us through a media program and we went to all the, you know, before the tournaments, talk to the media, tell them to all about what we were doing and our progress. So you would never find a sponsor like that again. I mean, we were fortunate.
And you worked hard. You got promoted. You signed every autograph. You were there and everything was wide open.
That's right.
There was major access. You did every single interview. You spoke to every single reporter.
That's right. We had to. First of all, the reporters, I mean, we had to educate them about tennis. I mean, they knew very little about tennis. I mean, they wanted to cover football, basketball, baseball, but women's tennis, that was like a nothing that they wanted to do. And so it was a good relationship that we established with many of the media people. And I think they supported us very, very well.
Rosie, how important was Billie Jean beating Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes to the whole program?
Ultimately, absolutely. Especially when Margaret Court lost. She was the first one that played.
Yeah, of course.
And I don't know, have you heard of the Mother's Day Massacre?
No.
Okay, so because she said yes and everybody else had said no, Billie Jean and I were coming from Japan playing doubles there, and we stopped in Honolulu, and you said, well, you know, we better put a quarter in one of those TV things where you used to sit down at the airport, put the quarter in and see what was going on with TV. And there we have the last couple games. She lost the first set at like 6-1 or 6-2, and she was down 5-1, getting ready to lose, and she lost. And, you know, Billie Jean said, now I've got to play him. Now this is what I have to do for women.
You were right there when she said that, huh? You were right there.
Yes. This is what I have to do for the women, because Margaret screwed that up.
Margaret screwed it up.
I think what happened to her, she was number one in the world, playing great tennis, beating everybody, but she really didn't understand what she was getting herself into. And Bobby Riggs is another, you know, interesting character that lives with, you know, making bets and doing crazy things. And he caught on very, very well. I think his whole spiel with being a chauvinist pig and, you know,
promoting,
he did a great job promoting himself, because really, if you think about this guy, 50, 53, whatever he was, all washed up. Nobody, I mean, he legitimately was a great player. I mean, you know, he won Wimbledon, he won everything, but he came up at a time where there was very little money, and he did play in the professionals, but you weren't getting paid a lot of money. So you're looking at all this money and you're thinking, how can I get there? How can I get some of this money? So he was brilliant. And as it turned out, we all became close friends, you know. So, but that was the match that was heard around the world, her beating him, that made women's tennis and women's sports and women in business.
Where were you for that match? You had to have been there, right? You were there?
Well, of course, I was with that stupid Howard Cosell.
You were broadcasting.
I was doing the color commentary with Howard Cosell.
And Howard was a jerk?
Well, he wasn't a jerk, but he was a chauvinist. He ruled ABC Wide World of Sports. I mean, period. He was the king, and he didn't know a lot about tennis. I mean, knew a lot about boxing and other things. And I got to say, he was a personality, and it was kind of fun to be with him, but it was kind of fun to correct him as well. And I don't think he was used to that if he made it mentioned. And I also was supposed to be doing with Jack Kramer, but Billie Jean told Rune Arlich, who was the producer, if Jack Kramer's on that, you know, and commentating, I will not play that match. And it went just before, 24 hours before, he finally said, okay, I'm going to pull Jack Kramer off the telecast and we'll get Gene Scott to do it.
Yeah, that's fact, huh? Billie Jean said, if you have Jack Kramer on this show, I'm out.
That's it. She didn't want to give him the platform to talk down tennis, okay? You know, this event will never be reproduced.
It was Buck Wild, huh?
There was a lot of drama on and off the court. It will never happen again, ever, because it's all about the timing. The timing was perfect. The Women's Lib, Title IX, everything was going on for women. Helen Reddy, I Am Woman. So it was a major, major victory for women.
So exciting just to hear these stories. What about your tennis?
Well, I mean, of course, not having reached number one was always, disappointing, because I felt it was a combination of some luck in not winning one of the finals at the US Open. I also feel that my size and the style of play that I played, I played a serve and volley game, which, you know, you had to have precision with a good first serve, with a good first volley, because I didn't have that reach that Margaret Court. So she had more room for error. I had very little, and I would have liked another 3 inches to put my 5.25. And I like to think that that would have made a difference, because, you look at Chris was 5'5", Billie Jean was 5'5", Martina was a giant at that time at 5'7" or something. We thought she was big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eventually you come to deal with the fact, well, who are you as a player? This is who you are. So you take it. And I would say that I had a pretty good career. I can't complain. You know, maybe my Wimbledon moments was becoming an original nine. Doing the things we did for women's tennis, establishing WTA, and, continuing to fight for women's rights and, you know, sports and everything. So I'm satisfied with where I am and what I did.
What's the moral to the story when you look back on your career?
The moral to the story is that you can always be what you want to be, even if it's not putting a number one on it. You have to look at your life and what you got out of it. And my life, I got a number one. I traveled the world. I made a good living. I met some wonderful people for life. Billie Jean's in my life forever. And as I am in hers, we are very good friends. Same thing with Martina and Chris. A lot of the other players that we were so close to, they were our family for such a long time on the tour. So when I look at things and I can reflect, then I can say I had meaning, I had purpose, and I feel I delivered, and I continue to deliver.
Let's move into the fourth set. This is the 10-ball scramble. I say it, it goes fast. I say it, you say what comes in your mind. You ready? Your favorite tournament. I think you already said it.
I hope so. Wimbledon.
Your favorite court.
Center court, Wimbledon.
Your favorite outfit that Ted Tinling ever gave you. Do you have a favorite?
I have a favorite one. Yes, it was the red, white, and blue that I made for the USA for Fed Cup.
Your favorite racket?
in the beginning. I would say that the T2000, which was a radical, the steel racket, and then my favorite became the Schnauert, which became the Spalding. So yeah, I played with that the longest, and then although I did start with Wilson, I was a Wilson girl.
I was watching some footage of you playing Billie Jean in the finals of the US Open 1971. You were playing with a T2000, but you had your own Spalding Rosie Casals racket.
That came later.
That racket was originally a Snauert.
Yeah, that was the original company
No.
that sold to Spalding. So yeah, and in Europe it's Schnauert, in America it was Spalding. In when I was using Wilson, okay, and everybody thinks Connors was the first one to use that, but it was Billie Jean, myself, and Ann Jones that used that T2000. That was the first revolutionized, I think, racket.
Wow, you used that before Jimmy. That's amazing.
Yeah.
What size was your grip?
At that time was a 4 5/8. Now I use a 4 1/2 or 4 3/8 because I use a Wilson blade. I love the blade.
Hang on a second. You play with a 4 5/8?
At that time, yeah, they were clunkers.
Wow.
We were used to having wooden rackets
Yeah.
and they were clunkers.
Yeah.
And then, when you started using something different with a different composite, a Technifier or whatever, all of a sudden, it changed, your grip changed a little bit. And now, I only because I put a overwrap on it, I use a 4 3/8. So yeah, I use a smaller racket now, grip size.
5'2", 4 5/8 grip. That's incredible. And how did you string your racket back then?
Well, we used gut a lot. And so that a 17 gauge gut. And that was special because you could feel the ball better. It was better than the nylon. But nowadays, with this new hybrids that they have, they're incredibly good. They're incredibly good. Sometimes they're better than the gut because it gives you a lot more spin, and that's what the players use so much of now.
Your favorite player growing up, was there someone you like to watch?
I like to watch. I remember watching Darlene Hard and Maria Bueno on TV, and that was only when the finals at Forest Hill for a moment. And
Yeah.
I liked them because they served in volley. It was something I could relate to. So, but it wasn't anybody in particular that said, I want to be like you.
Your favorite player to, now, is there anyone you love now?
No, I don't love anybody now. I mean, I like a combination of ground strokes and volleying. I like to watch Sabalenka because she's fun to watch because she's all out and she's drama and she's everything. So she's kind of fun to watch. Anybody else? Probably Ann Shabour would be somebody.
You like Jabor.
I think it really hurt her that she lost the two finals. I think her confidence went down and that she was injured, and now she's not looking like she's having fun. She doesn't look happy. Before, she was happy trying to get there. She finally gets there and she's not happy. But I enjoy watching her play because she is probably a pretty much all around type of player. And I think that's, I prefer to see that than one dimensional.
The most cavalier thing you ever did with prize money? Did you ever just like fly to Puerto Rico? Did you ever just go nuts?
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know that I went nuts, but what after I won the Family Circle Cup, the inaugural one in 1973, which gave the most prize money ever, it was $100,000 and $30,000 to the winner. I beat Nancy in the finals. I was driving down Wilshire in L.A. and I looked to the right, this Mercedes dealership, and in the window is a beautiful little 450 SL red convertible. So I made a right-hand turn in there and I told the guy, I said, how much is that car? $22,000. I said, I want it. So that's where my $30,000 went, to that car, 450 SL 1973.
That is something. That's all right. That's cool. Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the queen of the court. If you were the queen of tennis, you could make a change in the sport with no aggravation, anything. What would it be?
That's a good question. I want the players to work on establishing relationships with promoters and sponsors and giving back. I know many of them do, but I don't think we get to hear what they do. and we don't get to see that. And I think we need to see more. We see them win, take the money. They don't even show the check. I'm sure they don't even get the check. It goes to their agents, and that's it. But I think the relationship with the players and the association, WTA, is important. And I don't feel there's a good relationship or, a close one, let's say. There may be a good relationship, but not close enough. They need to really recognize how important WTA is to them and giving them all the things that they have. And they need to support that. And they need to support the promoters who keep dishing out and giving money and paying for everything. They need to be available. I feel they don't contribute enough. And I'm not signaling one person. I don't know. There may be some that do. I certainly don't know. But I think that I would like to see them treasure what they do, give back to the game, whether it be financially, whether it be time-wise or whatever. Just make the game better than when you walked in. And that's what I want to see.
Listen, I knew when I said hi to you, I knew I had a feeling that we would have an interesting chat. I have enjoyed this immensely. What happens to you for the rest of the year? Are you going to be in Paris? Will you be at the Royal Box at Wimbledon?
I won't be in Gay Perry, but I will be at Wimbledon, and I will hit center court, and I'll be enjoying my full 2 weeks there. We'll be celebrating also the 100th anniversary of Whiteman Cup, which is between Great Britain and the USA. Last time that it was played was in 1989. So we are going to celebrate that at Eastbourne on the finals day. And they will also be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Eastbourne. But I think the 100th, the centennial anniversary of the Whiteman Cup is really something that we cannot miss, because I know I won't be around for the next 100. But Hazel Whiteman is the person established that cup between Great Britain and the United States. And I had the privilege of meeting her when I was a junior, about 16 years old. I stayed in her house, and she was a very inspiring woman.
And you won 10 Whiteman Cups. You won 10 of those, at least.
Oh, really? Well, then you see, that's why we've done a whole lot to try and make it happen. And it's going to happen.
That's cool. Listen, thank you so much. And will we see you at the U.S. Open? Will you be at the U.S. Open?
Yeah, I'll be there.
And what do you and Billie Jean talk about when you're in the, when we see you in the Royal Box and the camera pans over and you sort of, I see you talking.
I don't know. We talk about all kinds of things. I mean, it depends on what's going on, but we talk about everything. I mean, we have a Zoom every Sunday, and it started during COVID because we couldn't get around. So we have about 8 good friends that participate, and every Sunday, 2 o'clock, we're on the horn, whether we see one another last week or the day before, or been on a cruise, doesn't matter. We hit every topic there is. So I can't tell you what we talk about, but sometimes it's tennis. A lot of times it's tennis. She agrees, I disagree, and we have our own podcast.
You keep it moving. Rosie Casals, thank you very much. Have a terrific rest of your week, and you are released.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'll look forward to catching up and listening to it.
Huge thank you to Rosie Casals, and thank you to Deodora. Use my code APPROVED in all caps at hollenbergsports.com for 15% off of all Deodora performance tennis shoes. ScopeSports.io is the official fan club platform of the podcast. See them at ScopeSports.io. Megan Fernandez edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.